Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project. My name's Alice, I'm a DJ at the absurd London club night Push the Button, and this podcast is the altar at which I worship the relationship between women and queer men. Today's episode is one of the most life-affirming conversations I have ever had. Originally from New Zealand, Flick Thorley nursed some of the first people to live and die with HIV there, some of them personal friends. After moving to London, she became a senior nurse at London Lighthouse, the AIDS centre famously visited by Princess Di. Flick went on to identify London's crystal meth problem and was instrumental in setting up London's Chemsex and Club Drug Clinic. There's more, because she's amazing. In 2002, Flick and her partner Chloe, an HIV doctor I interviewed in season one of The Dorothy Project, went to Botswana to set up the country's antiretroviral programme. And because of Botswana's laws, they couldn't be out as lesbians or as a couple the entire time. The work that Flick's done, her approach to life, which you'll hear from the way she speaks, and the way she talks about being part of the LGBT community, I haven't stopped thinking about it. I started by asking Flick how she found herself working in HIV medicine back in the 80s.
What was my first exposure to HIV was in the early 80s. Which was the first person I met with HIV. It's a pretty horrible story, but it was in 1980. Actually, no, that's not true. The first person I met with HIV was in 1984 or 1985, who was a really good friend of a close friend of mine. And he ended up dying. We ended up nursing him at home, and we didn't really know what was wrong with him at that time.
Oh, wow.
And he died. And I knew nothing about HIV at all at that time. And then I had friends come out to me as HIV positive. And interestingly, one of my friends from New Zealand in 1986, he had been diagnosed the year before. He is still alive and well and living in London. We're still
brilliant.
Mates. Yeah, so it's like, so that is a pretty amazing
thing.
Yeah. And we did our nursing training together in New Zealand, and then we bumped into each other in London in about 1991 when we'd both come to London, and we'd lost touch, and we were in a gay pub in Islington, and I was sitting waiting for somebody, and I heard this New Zealand accent say, can I sit here? Can I have this chair? And I look up and it was him. I'm like, oh my God. So that was really funny. We've been friends in London ever since. Because I came here in 89.
Oh, okay.
I didn't start working at London Lighthouse until 93 or 94. But how I ended up at London Lighthouse is I was working in a psychiatric unit, the Huntley Centre, which is part of UCH. And because I was interested in HIV, because at that point I had friends with HIV and I'd had my horrendous experiences with HIV and felt people deserved better than that. And we were having patients on our psychiatric ward that were HIV positive, and they'd been transferred over from Broderip ward, from the HIV wards at Middlesex, because they weren't coping with them, because they were dementing, they were psychotic, they had HIV, dementia, they would have PML, they had various brain illnesses, and the general nursing environment, they just weren't set up to manage them. So they ended up being transferred to us under the Mental Health Act. And then we weren't managing them physically because we didn't have sluice facilities. We had no way of disposing of, bodily fluids.
Yeah.
And it was just difficult. So I then sort of started doing like an informal psychiatric liaison service between our wards and the HIV service, where I would go and assess inpatients to see whether we would be able to manage them in the mental health unit. Most of the time we couldn't. It wasn't that we didn't want to, but it just wasn't the right environment. And the problem was neither of those places were perfect when people had both physical and psychiatric problems. And that was how I ended up at the Lighthouse, because that was a place that could do both of those things. And so I knew about it because when it opened, I was living pretty much around the corner from it. I was in Ladbroke Grove. And I remember people talking about all of the campaigning about in the neighbourhood, where there was loads of people pro the lighthouse being there, and then there were loads of people very anti the lighthouse being there. But it had already opened at that point. Mm. And so I went there to an open day, and I just thought, this is just where I want to work because it's the perfect place. And I was working in quite a gay environment already at the Huntley Centre. My charge nurse was a gay man. Half of the nurses on the ward were gay men. There was another lesbian. It was a very, like, all the straight women were fag hags. It was like we were a very gay team. And so then moving from that to the lighthouse was just sort of really natural, and it was like the perfect job for me for the next 4 years until the residential unit closed. I was a charge nurse on the residential unit.
When everything kind of changed, when the residential unit closed, like, what was that time like?
It was weird because it was good. You know, the fact that antiretrovirals had become available and people weren't dying at the rate they had been was amazing, because initially when I was working on the res unit, it was pretty traumatic, and nothing really prepares you for that sort of thing. I was in my 20s, my late 20s, and you know, people were dying every day. And we had a mortuary there. We had a 12-bed mortuary. And every shift, we would be allocated live patients and dead patients. And we would have to look after the people who were either dying or were there having respite care. And we also had people who died. And we were responsible for taking them out of the mortuary and putting them in the viewing room and supporting the friends and families who were coming to see them before their funerals. And, you know, our job was to wash them and prepare them and dress them. And some of the time it was really sad and difficult, and other times it was amazing. And it was also some of the funniest experience within, you know, a weird scenario, like, yeah, getting people, because it was an incredible time, because it was, people were dying and it was awful that they were dying, but they were, a lot of them were very much in control of, not very much, but what they were in control of, they were controlled of what they wanted around their deaths. And they spent, you know, I think HIV's informed a lot of really important things around palliative care, around caring for people in hospital environments, about patient advocacy, about expert patients, about people taking control of, you know, their deaths, about living wills, about all of that. And so, I mean, I just remember some mad scenarios dressing people in rubber suits for their funerals. And I must say, it's not easy to dress a dead person in a rubber suit. But there were some, you know, like, there were some amazing things. You know, like, we did some amazing things with people about allowing them or facilitating them to do what they wanted to do, yeah, which seemed impossible. Like, people who were dying and had the most horrendous diarrhea and whatever, but we would get them to the opera. Or, you know, like, it was amazing. So when antiretrovirals came and that started slowing down, it was amazing that people weren't dying like that in, yes, the same way. But there were still people that were, yeah, and there were still people that antiretrovirals at that stage, those drugs were difficult to take, and there were a lot of them, and the side effects of them were very difficult for lots of people. And, you know, some people just couldn't tolerate them or didn't want to try, or, you know, it was very complicated. And but the fact that the residential unit closed was a cause for celebration, but there was still a need for it, but not the need in the same way. Yeah. And because it was a slow process until the point where that type of care became pretty much unnecessary, which is Well, it's not true. There are still people who are diagnosed very late and who, you know, that's a very different scenario. But for the people who are diagnosed early and who get on treatment, that sort of environment is just totally unnecessary, which is amazing.
Yeah. And of course, I had your partner, Chloe, on this podcast in the last season. And the amount of work that she's done to kind of further that is amazing.
Yeah.
So when did you two meet?
Right, we met at Chelsea in Westminster. So she was a new SHO in the Cobler, and I was the psych liaison nurse for the HIV service. So that was in, when did we meet? That would have been 1998, I think. And yeah, so we met and we worked together and we became really good friends. And then we got together after a relationship that I'd been in with somebody I worked with had fallen apart. And I realized that working with somebody when that relationship goes bad is a very bad idea.
Yeah.
Because again, it was really difficult because going to work is often where you go to get away from your own life dramas,
yeah.
You know, and sort of going to work and your own life drama being there is not fun. So Chloe and I were really good friends, and we were sitting in the pub one evening, and lots of our friends kept asking if we were together, and we kept saying, no, we're not, we're just really good friends. We're just really good friends. It's like, fine. And then one day we were in the pub, and of course I hadn't noticed that Chloe didn't drink, but she was in the pub all the time, because I was in the pub. I did drink and I was in the pub all the time. But we were sitting in the pub this Friday with a friend of mine, and she sort of looked, so I was sort of bemoaning the fact that my ex was around and it was difficult, and you know, and my friend was saying, she was looking around and saying, oh God, there's two or three various people in this room that I've slept with, and it's just, I feel awful. I feel like crap. It doesn't make me feel nice. I don't want to do that, you know. And I said, look, I'm never going to have another relationship with anybody I work with again. It's just a terrible idea. I'm just never going to do it. And Chloe just said, I could always go and work somewhere else.
No.
She did.
That's like a line from a rom-com.
I know. And I just sort of looked at her, and Sue went, I'm going to the loo. Sue got up, left the room, and when she came back, we were sitting there holding hands, and we've been together ever since.
That's an amazing story. I wish I'd been able to put this out on Valentine's Day.
That's so true. I know. How romantic is that? And I was like, it was like it just hadn't occurred to me. It really hadn't occurred to me.
She was literally like,
she was just there, right there. Yeah, right there. And we spend loads of time together, and loads of people keep saying, are you together? No.
And then you more than worked together. So she was telling me you went to Botswana to deliver training to doctors and nurses.
Yeah.
So how did that come about, and how did that pan out?
Okay. We were together, and I think Professor Gazzard asked Chloe to go to Botswana because she was originally from South Africa, and so to go back and work in Africa to start the antiretroviral program in Botswana, because at that point Botswana had the highest incidence of HIV per capita in the world. South Africa had the most people with HIV,
right?
Because it's got a huge population.
Yeah.
But in Botswana, it's a small population. There was only about 3 million people, but more than a third of them were HIV positive.
More than a third of the population?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was staggering. And the statistics were even higher in hospitals. So in the hospital environment, it was like something like 70%. I mean, it was and they didn't have treatment. They had no antiretroviral. So it was like going back to pre-antiretroviral. So it was, people were just dying everywhere. People were dying in the corridors. People were dying in the car park. Staff were dying. Doctors and nurses were dying. You know, when we got there, you know, it was really difficult. You know, they'd run out of burial space in the country. it was a real crisis.
Yes.
So we, our job was to skill up the local people to provide, because they were, the drugs were being provided by Merck and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and but we needed the staff on the ground to be able to do it. So that's how, so then Chloe, they were going to send a pharmacist out with Chloe, but she asked if I could come, and instead of a pharmacist, and because of the type of work I did and all of the teaching that I did and the training that I did, so that seemed sort of logical in a way. So we were able to go out together, which was amazing. But as a lesbian couple, they were very clear. I mean, we're very out at work. We've never not been. But the organisation said we weren't allowed to be out when we went there, because in Botswana, being gay was a crime. So it's illegal. So and what happened in so we weren't allowed to come out under any circumstances, because we would sabotage the program. So we had to agree to that. So we had to have, the irony is, we had to have HIV tests before we went to go. It's like, okay, but to go to a country to help with their HIV crisis. But anyway, so we had to have HIV tests, and we had to be negative to go. We weren't allowed to come out at all. We weren't allowed to come out individually, we weren't allowed to come out as a couple. And so off we went in the closet to Botswana.
And how long were you going to be out there for?
6 months.
Wow.
And it was very complicated, but it was amazing. It was one of those things. We'd only been together about 6 months or so at that point. We hadn't been together for very long. So it was a real serious make or break moment.
Yeah.
Like, and it made us. Like, it was just... it was an incredible experience.
Yeah.
But when we
I know people at that stage who were like not even leaving a toothbrush at their other house, and you're like, wow.
So it was such an incredible experience. But in Botswana, the way the laws worked at the time was if you were a native of Botswana, a Batswana or Motswana, you were gay and you were outed, you would be imprisoned. And if you were a foreigner, you'd be deported. So that it was really, really tantamount that we didn't come out and that we weren't outed. But what was hilarious, so we were there, we had no friends, so we couldn't have friends really, because we couldn't talk to anybody. We weren't allowed to talk to anybody. There wasn't much way of socialising, because the only way to socialise was either in shebeens, which were the local drinking things, which weren't safe for women, or church. And as two good atheists, we weren't going to be going there. So there was sort of not much to do. And it's a very long, funny story, but so when we got there, we did eventually have friends. I mean, I think I found the only gay man in the village and we became really good friends. We used to go riding. We went horse riding together. And so we weren't allowed. But what was also very funny is I'm 9 years older than Chloe, and we clearly are a couple. We've got all of that couple body language, whatever. But culturally, they could see the difference, but they thought I was her mother. We would go places. Like, we would get on the bus, on the minibus or whatever, and we would get on and Chloe would sit down and somebody would get all outraged at her and go, Ma, get up for your mother. Get up for your mother. And so I would just like sit down.
It was really good. It worked out for you in a way.
Brilliant. And then we'd like go into shopping malls and things like that, and somebody would go, Ma, your daughter, she is in there. And I'm like, okay, thank you.
Fine.
And then because we slept in the same bed, we had the house, it was so funny. It's a very funny story, but it's a long story that's not for this. But we had different bedrooms and different beds, but we slept in the same bed. But in Botswana, it was completely normal for mother and daughter to share a bed. So nobody, our housekeeper, didn't question it. I mean, we were careful, but not. We didn't have to be that careful because it just wasn't an issue. If we were two men, it would have been a different matter.
Right.
But for a mother and daughter, and they honestly thought that we were mother and daughter.
What I've seen from people I know who've like lived in really conservative like countries like that is that because it's so taboo and it's like
you're hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, and you know there are people who live in Dubai with their like roommate, and it's actually easier to do that than to be a straight unmarried couple.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, very topsy turvy. Yeah, don't there must have been like the people that you were working with and treating. It just so different from your experiences.
Oh,
like,
absolutely. I mean, it was an incredibly steep learning curve for me. I loved it. It was amazing. We met some amazing people and we did make friends. And we, by the end of it, you know, the first few months, I was just like, oh, I just wanted to come home. But whilst doing an amazing job, when you're at work, great. But the rest of it was, we had no TV, we had no phones, we had no internet. We were really isolated.
Yeah.
It was dark at 6 o'clock in the evenings. You know, in Africa, it gets dark very early.
Yeah, and really quickly as well.
Yeah, really quickly. I mean, it was amazing. We had an amazing time.
Yeah. And you've gone on to work and to identify, I guess, the problems with chemsex.
Yep.
So for some of our listeners who maybe don't know what chemsex is, how would you describe it?
Sex on chemicals. Pretty much.
Clues in the name.
Yeah, the clues in the name, yeah. Well, the biggest problem that I was witnessing was the crystal meth epidemic, really. And I saw it had been a problem in America a long time before it was a problem here. And it was in America, I don't know, some people may have seen, there are documentaries that Louis Theroux did about crystal meth in America, where crystal meth in America really was historically a heterosexual drug of poverty. And it was like trailer park, sort of white trash, you know, to use, you know, terrible, those sort of, you know, it was a drug associated with crime and poverty. And gay men adapted it as a drug of hedonism and sex and partying. Because I think the thing about it is it's a complicated drug, but if it gets its claws into you, you're in big trouble. And I started seeing people who were in really big trouble because they were psychotic, and it was causing real difficulties with people and their reality, their relationship with reality and their relationship with their lives. And it was causing absolute mayhem. And I started to see this in people, and there was sort of nowhere to get the appropriate help. And I was turning to America to try and understand what was happening and what was happening here. And so I initially started engaging Antidote, which was a gay drug project in Soho, and like asking for support from them.
And when was this?
When? This was in the mid-90s. I think the first person I met with a crystal meth psychosis was in 95, and that was a one-off, really. He presented to A&E at Chelsea and Westminster. He was one of our patients. He was a Cobler patient, and he come to A&E with some unrelated issue. So it wasn't HIV related. So he'd gone to A&E rather than come to the Cobler. But they'd called me because he was one of our patients, and what was going on wasn't making any sense at all. And so I went and saw him, and he started telling me about this drug that he'd taken in America and that he'd just come back from America. And it was clear that he was psychotic and he had no history of psychiatric illness. Right. And it was sort of putting two and two together, it became really clear that he had a drug-related psychosis and that it seemed to be to do with this drug, and which I knew absolutely nothing about and had never heard of. And so he was the first. And then not very long after that, I met another guy with a very similar presentation who was very psychotic and very paranoid, very frightened. And that was all clearly crystal meth related. And by that point, crystal meth was here in the UK. And that was maybe 96. And I did a documentary. It was on TV a few years ago about crystal meth and about all of that and about the original sort of casualties of crystal meth. But it was becoming a real problem, and we did a survey in the clinic about looking at, because I thought it was a bigger problem than other people seemed to think it was, and so we did this we did a survey, and it was a bigger problem. And so luckily then I approached the drug service at Chelsea and Westminster, and they were really keen to get involved, because providing drug services for gay men who are taking drugs while partying and having sex is a different matter than dealing with people who are heroin dependent or on methadone or, you know, street drug users. It's a different, you know, but this was trying to deal with people who did not see themselves as having any drug related problems, but that actually their drug use was imploding on their lives and causing like major health problems around HIV, around hepatitis, like lots of unsafe sex, lots of unsafe drug use, lots of, suddenly we went from years and years and years of safe, you know, needle exchange work and people not sharing needles to these guys sharing needles, you know, because it was a whole different ball game. It was a different type of drug use. And the chemsex is a much bigger thing than that. I got involved in all of that because of the people presenting with acute psychiatric problems as a result. But there is, you know, it's a much broader thing, and there's a brilliant service in Soho now, the chemsex service, that's, you know, the club drug service that is running now, and, you know, I'm out of the loop now. But I think they provide an amazing, like, resource, you know, and education to men. Because it's, in reality, you know, if you think about internalised homophobia, just homophobia in general, drinking, you know, whether you're, you know, a woman or a man or, you know, trans or whatever, drugs and alcohol have been the numbing way for us to manage, you know, things that's seen as socially unacceptable for a very long time. So these sorts of drugs that are just mind-numbingly, you know, exciting, it's the perfect storm in the gay community.
Yeah, and it feels like I didn't realise it had been a problem for that long, I have to say, and feels like it's quite an intractable problem. Like, I even saw tweets last week about, you know, new guidelines about how to take G safely, and a few people just being like, can you even? Like, is it responsible? Because,
I mean, I think, you know, the reality is, just say no. It doesn't work. But, you know, it still was the safest thing. But then the reality is, so then people were doing it, so then you've got to look at how they do it as safely as they can.
Yeah.
And that's complicated. Because what you do when you're not under the influence is very different to what you do when you are.
Yeah.
You know, but it's the same with alcohol. You know, actually, it's the same with, you know, all of it. But the fact that there is education, people are talking about it, it is stuff that's being put out there, you know, by gay men for gay men, is much easier for people to access than being told by some drug service, NHS drug service, that have got no idea what your life is.
And you sort of touched on it, but like, it feels like you were really set up to work in that area because of your experiences, and specifically because it intersects with mental health so much. But like, what's it been your whole career, spent so much time like looking after gay men when you're not one?
It is really weird, because gay men have been so formative in my life. Like, literally, I mean, HIV pretty much provided my career, you know, a successful career, my relationship, a successful relationship, most of my friends, really good friends. You know, it's caused me lots of sadness. It's caused me lots of amazing things. Gay men have been absolutely part of that, and if not, you know, like a huge part of that. I don't know, I think I've always been a bit of a fag hag. It was just going to happen, really. Like, most of my friends are gay men, and always have been. When I first came to London, like the first people, my first closest friends I made were gay men. I think the first day my friend that I came to London with picked me up at the airport, we drove straight to the Angel in Islington. I sat on a bar stool with Jimmy Somerville. And
wow, was like, really going yeah, right in yeah, there.
No, absolutely, I was right in there. I was like born for this. And it was like, and I just didn't stop. And it was like, and then my first job that I got when I came here, I was working in a housing, like a housing project in West London, looking after people with mental health problems that was the care in the community, the early, you know, this was in 89, this was when they were shutting the big psychiatric hospitals around the outskirts of London. And one of the first people I was working with was a gay man with HIV, and that was in 89. So one of the first people I met in London was a gay man with HIV. We are still really good friends. He is still alive and well. And we are still really good friends. And he introduced me to ACT UP, which was really funny because him and I used to go to Pentonville Prison and throw condoms over the wall. And I'd come from New Zealand where activism was like really important. Like I'd protest against the Springbok. I got arrested again, you know, when the Springboks were like, you know, came to New Zealand with the rugby tour. I remember the poll tax. We were like the poll tax riots here. You know, protest was something I was really pro. So that was quite cool. That was quite fun doing that.
Yeah, it sounds it. And I was going to ask you what your favourite memory from this whole time was, but...
Oh, there's too many.
Yeah.
There's dozens, sounds hundreds. Like it. There's so many. I mean, it's been an amazing thing. It's like I am eternally grateful to gay men. I think it was, you know, I came out... Again, it was a bit like my insightlessness about my relationship with Chloe. I was insightless with my own sexuality. And I was surrounded by gay men. They were all, you know, and they all joked about, everybody kept saying I was a lesbian. I was like, no, I'm not. I'm just asexual. I'm just not interested in anybody. And then I ended up, through my gay male friends, ending up living with loads of lesbians. And then I was in a lesbian band, but I was the straight one. I was the token straight one. I wasn't allowed in loads of venues and all sorts of things because I was straight. Then I came out, but I was, and I think it was, I don't know how, I mean, coming out was a very funny story, but it was something about me. I'd already immersed myself in gay culture before I came out. And I wasn't closeted because I was insightless. Like I had absolutely no understanding of my sexuality at all. But, you know, I came out with bells and whistles and that was it. I was off. But, you know, I mean, I think gay culture, I feel really privileged to be a lesbian, actually. I think I feel really lucky. It's to be outside the mainstream. It's being gay and being living in the Western world in a big city in a privileged situation. Being white, middle class and gay, I can hide and I don't try to. But I can, and I am invisible in so many ways where I don't have to deal with discrimination and violence and all sorts of difficulty. But I can take it on when I want to. But I think I feel very privileged that I've been able to work as an out lesbian my entire career, my entire life, and it's never been something I've had to hide. It's always been something I've been able to help other people come out. I've always been able, I've been an unintentional role model at different times, and I feel proud of that. Like, and I feel lucky, and I know not everybody is in that situation, but I feel very, you know, I feel, yeah, I recommend it.
5 stars. I wish I could get what Chloe just said, like, printed on a tea towel so I never forget it. Dorothy Project merch? Before I go, and in light of our conversation about chemsex, I wanted to say that if you're worried about your drug or alcohol use or that of a friend or someone in your family, then there's plenty of support out there. Antidote, the LGBT drug and alcohol service, which is based at the charity London Friend, suggests that you seek help as early as possible to prevent things getting worse. That doesn't have to mean giving up completely. You can set goals to cut down and get back more control about when you use, who with, and what you do while you're using. Antidote provides support to LGBT people in London, as do the LGBT Foundation in Manchester and Birmingham LGBT in Birmingham. But if you're straight or you don't live in one of those cities, then there will be drug and alcohol services provided by every local authority, and you'll be able to find out where yours is from your local authority's website. You can also get chemsex support from your sexual health clinic, especially those that work with a lot of gay men. And I've put links to these organisations on this week's episode notes and on our social media at Dorothy_podcast. See you next week.